This Sunday Show with EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum, an interactive journey that shows how a small island made a big impact on the world. EPICCHQ.com.
Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to the Sunday Show, and I'm delighted to be joined this evening by Barbara Scully, a well-known writer, broadcaster, raconteur, funny person, and an amazing woman. Barbara, I'm delighted. Thank you so much for being into the studio.
You bribed me to come in here. Why don't you tell all your listeners? I've been sitting here munching on really nice posh chocolate. I'll come back in here anytime you want.
No expense spared for the guests on Sunshine Radio.
Proper,
Barbara.
Posh chocolate. I'm really impressed.
Now, of course, we're going to chat this evening about your fabulous book that you wrote, I actually had a good through myself and I'm enjoying immensely, by the way. I think a book for everybody. You and I have a lot of stuff in common. We both love travel. We both worked in travel, and I think it's a fabulous industry, and I'd love to just, I know you do travel and PR, but just a little bit about your journey. I know you have an amazing mission empowering women, and I'm a great fan of yours, Barbara. So just in terms of your early career and what moulded you?
Oh God. Do you know what moulded me was, and I think I'm very similar to anybody who's my age. Growing up in the kind of 60s and 70s in Ireland, there weren't a lot of careers open to women. There was jobs done by the boys. So if you were in school, you were prepared, nuns usually, to be a secretary, or maybe if you were smart, a teacher or a nurse. I went to the bank, and none of those appealed to me. But what always appealed to me from the time I was quite young was working as an air hostess, and specifically working for Aer Lingus. And I always just assumed that was what I was going to do. I was going to work for Aer Lingus. And I mean, this is back in the day when there was very few things that Ireland did that were world class. But one of the things that we did was our airline was world class. And we had this amazing, cool, I'm talking about in the 70s, cool airline. You're probably too young to remember. They had offices in New York on Fifth Avenue. These air hostesses, who were all women, wore designer uniforms. They were seen as not just ambassadors for the airline, but they were seen as ambassadors for the country. Really. So I just thought, and as well as that, then you were going to travel. And this was back in the day when travel was expensive. So a job that would allow me to travel as well, wear this lovely uniform. I'm a bit of an aviation nerd.
The Coco Chanel of airline uniforms.
Absolutely. I thought, this is me. This is what I'm going to do. And sometime, probably when I was in early years in secondary school, I realised I'm 6 foot tall, and I hit my 6 foot tall probably when I was about 15, and I suddenly realised I was heading towards that. I was too tall to be an air hostess. I think their upper height restriction then was 5 foot seven. So I wasn't just like slightly outside. I was like well outside the range for being an air hostess, and a dream died. And I remember thinking, oh, that's terrible. And my father, which is probably part of the reason, another part of the reason why I loved the idea of working for an airline. My father worked at Dublin Airport when I was very young. He was in customs and excise. So I remember as a kid being brought out, now this is the old Collinstown terminal, being brought out to Dublin Airport with him, and the smell of aviation fuel, the sound of jet engines, like still makes me kind of like weak. So he said to me, well, look, if you're too tall to be an air hostess, you could apply to be a ground hostess. So I thought, okay, I'm not flying every day, but I've got the uniform and I look a bit important, and I'm down on the gate and I'm checking people in, I'm doing whatever. I thought, yeah, maybe that would do. And so when I left school in 1979, Aer Lingus advertised looking for ground ops, and I applied, and I was called in to do something called an aptitude test. Now, I don't know what kind of dyslexia I have, but I couldn't make head. It was these things like, here's a box or a shape.
Spatial awareness.
And when you unfold it, which one is it? And I'd be like, I hadn't a breeze, not a rasher. So again, gutted to get the Dear John letter. Thanks very much, but you failed the aptitude test, and another dream died. And so I signed up for a commercial course, and I thought, I'm on my way to being a secretary, with all due respect to anybody who is secretaries, but I didn't want to be a secretary. And I struggled of trying to learn to type, trying to learn shorthand for about 3 months. And then a company who were like, again, iconic brand at the time, JWT, advertised looking for sales staff. And I thought, okay, the uniform isn't quite as smart, but it is travel. So I applied and I got the job.
Some of the travel agents were very snazzy. I remember United Travel, used to look like Gulf Air.
Did in the days before there was a Gulf Air. Yeah. Well, Joe Walsh Tours had a uniform. It had too many colours though. We had we had a grey skirt, we had a navy blazer, we had a white shirt, and then we had a scarf that had red and navy and white in it as well. But I started working for JWT, and from the first day I crossed the threshold into the office in Baggot Street, I loved it. It was, I mean, it was a young company. There was, we were all almost, I'd say, under 30, management as well as the staff. It wasn't, travel wasn't as, in one way, it was very regulated. In other ways, it wasn't as regulated as it is now. So we could, if there was seats out on a flight going down to Mallorca on a Friday and seats coming in from Ibiza on a Sunday, no problem. Off you go. You know, on standby, you could go down and come back. So I just thought, I mean,
sure,
this
was great. You could write the tickets then, sure, wasn't
it
great?
I remember the telex
going.
And the big long thing you used, if you had a long telex,
you could write your own ticket.
And a cable. But yeah, no, it was absolutely amazing. And it's hard now, I think, for like my kids to understand, because they have such opportunities to travel because airfares have come down. And nowadays, kids travel all over the world before they settle down. But back in the 80s, that just wasn't an option. So for me to be able to go to Mallorca for the weekend or go to Gran Canaria for the weekend was like really exciting. So yeah, it was great days, made great friends from that time, and have stayed in touch with the travel business ever since. And I absolutely love to travel. And I'm the bloody idiot who has, even the other day, you know, when you get a cold winter's day,
yeah,
where there's no clouds in the sky, and I could be walking along with anybody and you see the vapour trails in the sky and I'm going, do you want to know where that plane's going? And people are like, no, I don't care. There was two yesterday that were going parallel. One was going to Toronto and the other was going to somewhere else, in Canada. And I was like, look, people are looking at me going,
it's amazing when you go out the back row there at the airport, all the cars lined up. I mean, it's a huge thing, plane spotting, you know. And now,
I don't plane spot.
Were you out for the big Chinese one that came in recently?
No, and I have an uncle who's a complete and utter 100%. He worked for Aer Lingus for years, so he absolutely is totally. So he'd let me know what's happening. But no, I don't generally, but I am the type who, if any of my kids are coming home and I'm picking them up, I have to get to the airport in time to see the flight land. So I park out the back with all the nerds watching the flight land, because I have this, then my kids laugh at me and say, Mom thinks that the flight's going to crash if she's not there to watch it actually landing. But it's perfect because you can watch the flight land and then I go, okay, they're home, they're safe, and I like watching airplanes land anyway. And then by the time you've driven around and parked, you don't have that long to wait for them to come through. But I'll tell you just one of the funny story. When my kids were small, right, we had a car with a sunroof.
Very posh.
Yeah, we used to go out to the back of the airport regularly for something to do when the kids were small, and we'd watch the airplanes. And my youngest daughter said to me only recently, she said, Mom, I only realised when I was in first year that wasn't normal, that everybody didn't do it. She says, I remember we were talking to her friends and she was, they were talking about the things they did when they were kids with their parents, entertaining them, going to the zoo or going to the beach. And she goes, yeah, and then you go out to the back of the airport and they all looked at her going, you went where? To do what? And she goes, watch airplanes. And they all said, nobody else did that.
But it's amazing. It is a passion though. It is. And it's a thing that people love. I'm the same.
And I've never got over the whole magic of flying, you know.
I'm off now soon to Switzerland, and even though it's only a short flight, it's a new place for me, Basel, but it's just the joy of a new place, and then when it's a new flight, and again,
and the fact
you wake up in a completely different culture.
Exactly, that to me is
but
still
it is amazing.
And I was very lucky in the autumn myself, and there's a reason why we did this, but we ended up going to Argentina on holiday, and flying back from Buenos Aires, we were flying with Lufthansa over Frankfurt, and we got to the airport in Buenos Aires, and we're down at the gate and I'm watching the flight and I'm like, oh my God, we're flying back on a 747. And again, my kids were like, so what? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I remember Aer Lingus taking delivery of the first 747 and they flew it in low over the city so we could all be in awe of this amazing, huge aircraft. It was an iconic aircraft. And again, like I still get excited. I'm like, I didn't realise Lufthansa. I think they're the only airline that still flies 747s. Fabulous.
It is. And can you remember your first flight?
Yes, I can. We went on holidays with my parents. They took us to Spain and we flew to Barcelona, and I can remember. But somehow the more flights I take, the more in love with flying I get.
Yeah.
And again, I've said already, I'm 6 foot tall and I have a daughter, my eldest lives in Australia, so we fly to Australia. Obviously we didn't during COVID, but we fly to Australia reasonably regularly, and people often say, particularly older people, of which I am now one, you know, oh, that's too long, oh no, I couldn't be doing that flight. And I'm like, it is not climbing Mount Everest. you just have to sit on your fat ass for a whole load of hours and eat, okay, rubbish food. But if you bring, as we do, a swag bag with all kinds of treats in it, you're fine. Watch some movies, listen to some podcasts, read your book. It's actually not difficult. And the more I fly, the more I actually really like it.
Yeah, but it's a great, I mean, for me, I just love three movies back to back. It's like brilliant.
It's great. And I can doze as well.
But not, I mean, the world, of course, has become smaller. I mean, do you break it up? I mean, a lot of people would say now, advice wise, I mean, the short, for like, do you break it up?
Generally, I don't. If I'm going to Australia, I used to do it straight. Yeah. However, airfares have now become so expensive. Mm. The long haul airfares, we're going in April and we haven't been for a year and a half. And when I checked the airfares, I was horrified because we normally go to the Middle East. My daughter's in Perth. So if you go down through Doha with Qatar, or if you go with Emirates over Dubai, it's a straight line, basically, if you like, from Dublin. It's the most direct route you can take, and there's only a 2-hour layover. So you're literally off and back on again, and off you go, and it's fine. But the fares were so expensive. So this time I'm going with Malaysian, and we're going Dublin, London, Kuala Lumpur, Perth. So it's adding on a little bit. Again, I don't mind. And we're going to take a bit of a stopover in Kuala Lumpur on the way back.
Yeah, no, very interesting, because I know people recently, they did a great one and they went with Cathay Pacific again from London, and they went via Hong Kong or something, you know, but again, 500 quid cheaper or something.
Yes, exactly. Ours was a lot cheaper. I can't remember the figures now, but it really made sense.
So you become an expert, of course, when you're going travelling a lot like that.
And I'm also an expert on long haul. If anybody wants to know how to do long haul properly, I am your woman. I have these rigid rules that I enforce on anybody who travels with me about what to wear, the fact that you are, I don't do jet lag. I don't do jet lag.
Do you have a bag full of melatonin or
what? No. What I do is, as soon as I get on, it doesn't matter how many flights I'm taking, but say, let's make it simple, and we're going to Doha. You get on the flight at Dublin, you put your watch on Doha time, right?
Smart.
And that's the time it is. You don't start doing this, oh, if we were at home now, we'd be only having our breakfast. Or if we were at home now, we'd be doing this. That kind of talk is not allowed. And then, as soon as you get to Doha, as soon as you board for Perth, your watch is on Perth time, and there's no more thinking of what time it is in Dublin or Doha. You're now on Perth time. And when you arrive, you stay up until bedtime, regardless of what time you arrive at. And drink lots of water.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I did Cleveland in September. Amazing. We have direct flights there as well. And I did exactly that. I did the thing, stayed up. No, it wasn't difficult. I found a great sports bar and I was watching the elephant. But you can do it, no problem. But it's much better, isn't it, for you?
Oh, it's much better. Yeah. If you start doing this, well, I'll just go for a nap now, because at home it's actually midnight, which is crazy. So if you, it's like jumping in, I would imagine. Not that I do sea swimming, but it's like if you go sea swimming in the winter and you're going to walk in slowly, you're going to die. Whereas if you jump in and just go for it, that's the way to go. So yeah.
Brilliant. I flew across the Atlantic once from Paris to New York in 3 hours, 45 minutes.
On Concorde?
Yes.
Oh, you did not.
£5,000, right? It was in the noughties.
Back of the day, wow.
And it was basically, I mean, it was incredible.
I'd say it was. Yeah. I'd say it was.
It was one long lunch. You got the runway, with a big long runway, but of course I did the Air France thing, so they flew you to Paris, AF1, and off you went. And you remember the dictaphones, Barbara?
Yes,
remember?
I do. Yes.
So I was going to record everything, a diligent little travel agent I was doing. And if you heard at the end, by the time the crew, because it's like you're in your own restaurant, right? Because it's your wine.
It's making no sense.
So I was slightly slug by the time we fell off. It was incredible, but it was amazing, I must say. Yeah, I would love, I mean, it would be so incredible if they could bring it back. Yeah. But yeah,
I would have loved that. I remember going out to Dublin Airport once, because it came in once or twice to Dublin on charters came in and out for special events and stuff. And I remember going out to watch it, but I would have given anything to have flown on it. Yeah, that's amazing. I flew on it's not Concorde, and I mentioned the 747 already, but the other aircraft that I really loved was the
A380. Oh, yeah.
Which, amazing. It's an amazing, beautiful air. And you know, the bigger the aircraft, the more comfortable they seem to be.
But that has a bar and everything.
It was a lovely experience, you know, but I believe they're going out of commission now as well, because they're too expensive. They're not economical. Same as Concorde, which killed Concorde in the end. It just wasn't economical, you know, but it was a fantastic project.
Yeah, you were talking about Aer Lingus earlier, I mean, and the new planes that the different airlines have now, the NAST, the GEOs, the more sustainable ones, you know, they're quieter. They're actually very nice as well. Yeah. So, you know, what kind of, but it's not, you know, it's not the A380
experience. No, it's not.
And tell me, are you a cruising woman? Do you like cruises? Yeah, no. No, you're not.
No, I'm not. No, and I know, you know.
Have you tried it?
I haven't tried cruising. Okay. I have been invited onto cruise ships that were in Dublin. For the lunch and things, to go and have a tour and all the rest of it. And, you know, I know I'm now going to shoot myself in the foot of ever being invited on a cruise by anybody.
Well, there's a lot of them around now.
Yeah,
so.
But no, my idea of absolute hell, I hate all the shiny chrome and the neon lighting and the... There's not enough outdoor space. I'm afraid I can't see
cruising. The new icon of the seas that just this that can take 7,000 plus with 20 stories,
No, 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 not at all. Now, having said that, if somebody wants me to try it out just to check, but no,
well, you could dip your foot. I mean, the smaller ships, like, you know, the Azamara range, you know, they only take 500, 600, and they go, you know, they go in closer into the ports. They're actually very much about the food, and they're quite nice, Barbara.
I would like that. You see, I'd like the kind of Titanic vibe of being able to walk.
I did the Queen Mary across the Atlantic.
I would be able to do eight days. No, I think I'd be able to do that. But no, these huge, big, like tower block things with all the like with it's like being on a water park and with slides and with it's like being in Las Vegas and no.
Well, you see, you have to. Yeah, you if you your travel, you need to tell your travel agent that you don't like this or you don't
no,
like. You don't.
I'd
want
like the
to
real
be,
expensive ones with the like you know more crew than clients
you'd love,
on board.
You'd love the Queen Mary then because they had Bill Bryson on giving a lecture.
Oh, he's great.
The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra were playing.
Oh, see, that's my vibe.
And you had dinner with Captain Wells three or four nights. It was incredible. I actually met a lady who was 100 years old, Jean, whose husband was a surgeon in the Bronx, and she never got on a plane, and it was her 100th cruise, imagine. And I mistakenly said, this is a lovely cruise, to which I was told by this Downton Abbey-like woman, it's not a cruise, it's a crossing. It's of a course, crossing. Which it was, because we didn't stop off anywhere.
Off anywhere, yes.
But I think we're going to have to find a little cruise for you. Because
my daughter, I mentioned we were in Argentina. The reason that we ended up going to Argentina was that my middle daughter, who's also got the travel bug, she was going to Antarctica. So we went with her down as far as Ushuaia. But I mean, the ship that she was on, which was again more of a scientific kind of cruise,
expedition,
and it was small. There was only 200 people
on it. Well, they're amazing.
And that would, I would definitely
you
give
would
something
love
like that.
They're only about 20 grand. You'd
but
be
don't
grand.
Put me on a ship with like thousands and thousands of other people. I mean, my idea now of a holiday, I mean, I know I've talked about travel and I love traveling and I love going to see new places and new cultures and all the rest of it. But actually, if I really want to relax, I head down to West Cork to the middle of nowhere and I talk to donkeys. And that's my
lots
idea.
Lots of donkeys in West Cork, of course.
And where it's pitch black dark at night and where it's so quiet it's almost loud and
well I visited I know I did a sound bath in the Sky Garden in Lisard Estate recently.
Everything I say you up me you J- one up
James
me.
Terrell, you know, the famous artist. You'd have to try this, and it's the most beautiful. It's like you're in a big green womb because it's all grass and you look up to the sky
and
you do a sound bath. You have to try
it in Lisard.
Amazing. But
where's Lisard near?
It's West Cork. It's near Skibbereen. But it's just incredible. It was one of those things, and you lie on an Egyptian plinth and Hayley does the sound bath while you're there.
And how did you feel after that?
Like all cleared and cleansed, and all the energy, all the blockages were gone, Barbara.
I don't need to hear that
because you're completely cleansed
and
everything.
Unblocked.
I heard you talking. You made me laugh. You had your ears syringed recently and I heard you saying a very funny line that you could hear the grass grow. It fell off. I thought
it was a revelation. It was a revelation. The amount of people, I put that up on Instagram. The amount of people who contacted me afterwards saying, oh my God, I'm going to get my ears syringed. Because you know the way, as you get older, I'm 62.
Yes.
And I knew my hearing wasn't as great. Now I'm married to a man who's absolutely deaf as a post and is in denial about it. And it'll be the cause of us divorcing because, you know, he goes around and he's completely
clueless. What did you say?
And then when I say something again, and I go, did you not hear me? And he goes, it's always my fault. Oh, you were talking into the cupboard or you were talking low or you were, anyway. But no, I got my ears syringed because I had a feeling that they were doing funny things and I was hearing buzzing noises and everything.
Brilliant.
It was a revelation. I was a new woman.
Well, you'll really enjoy the sky bath now. You'll be hearing the grass grow there. Listen, moving on, right? You then went into PR.
Well, I became a single parent, or an unmarried mother, as we were very beautifully called. And so I left the travel business kind of reluctantly, but as you know, it doesn't pay that well and the hours are all over the shop. I did some computer teaching for a while then with my mother, had set up a business, and I didn't really like that. And then from that, I went into PR and I worked for the Alzheimer's Society. I was their first PRO and fundraising manager. This was back in the kind of early 90s. Mm. So I worked there for nearly 10 years. And again, it was at a time when, you know, nobody really knew what Alzheimer's was. Nobody'd heard about about it. It was an interesting time to be doing the public relations for a disease that you'd ring up places and you'd say, I'm from the Alzheimer's Society. And they go, you're from the what? Can you spell that? What is it?
So it's amazing. And nowadays, Barbara, like it seems like there's a pandemic of dementia.
Well, of course, we're all living longer. Yeah. And it is very much an age-related disease. Yeah. You know, the older you get, the more people there are that are affected by it. But it's not, you know, I mean, I think one of the things we have to be careful of with aging is assuming that we're all going to get anything, because we're not. And research is ongoing into how to protect yourself from something like Alzheimer's to the best of our ability. And I know there was some interesting research, I think it was only this week, about proteins and proteins in the brain, and they may have a blood test now that can detect Alzheimer's very early. But it was an interesting time to be doing that.
So you had your foray into PR then,
I had my foray into PR, but it was kind of worthy PR.
Yeah.
No, because it was absolutely for a charity. So there was a kind of an element of kind of frontier work about doing that. But then I got married and I had two more children, and so I had a teenager, I had a toddler, and then I had a new baby. And myself and my husband were both, he's a freelance photographer, I was working in the Alzheimer's Society. Neither of us had jobs that were 9 to 5. I couldn't dance any faster. I just said no, and I was dropping all the balls. So we decided that I'd take a year out to be at home with the kids and just gather ourselves a little bit, and that year turned into 10 years. I'm now on my fifth career. This incarnation that sits in front of you is on her fifth career, because I count the 10 years
and
at home
looking fabulous, I have to say. Your mission is very interesting. I mean, and I think for women out there, a lot of people struggle, men as well, when we get to a certain age. You know, you remember your dad being like in his 50s, you thought he was ancient, and then all of a sudden you turn around and you're there. I mean, it's wonderful what you're doing, because I think everything has changed so much, hasn't it? Age is now, I know people say, oh, it's only a number. It's hard to take that in when you're going through it, but you are really on a kind of a mission to empower women about not worrying about the age.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I wrote a book called Wise Up, which I wrote mainly during the lockdowns, but it was stuff that I'd been thinking about for a long time. And one of the things that I noticed as I got older, like into my late 50s, was life wasn't what I had expected it to be, because we're told, especially women are told, you know, that as you age and as you get older and as you head into your 60s, you know, that you're on this kind of downward spiral towards death and destruction, number one. In other words, you know, life is just going to get harder and worser. And then number two, as a woman, you're told you're invisible. And then you're also told that you should be fighting aging. That's really the biggest thing you need to be doing now, is fighting aging. And I found all of that to be absolute nonsense. You know, and I suddenly realised this time of life is delicious. Like, the first thing was there is so much talk nowadays, which is good, and I welcome it, about menopause. Because for a long time, women's biology wasn't spoken about in polite society. So whether it was periods or childbirth or menopause, wasn't spoken about. I mean, I remember growing up listening to my mother talking about Mary up the road, who was going through the change. And I remember as a kid thinking, I wonder what the hell Mary's changing into. Like, what the hell is going on? So it's good that we now talk about it, but an awful lot of the talk about menopause, in fact, I would say 95%+ of it is negative, is about all the, you know, the difficulties. And I know some women do have a difficult time with menopause, but not every woman does. Mm. A lot of women, you know, cope with it as well as you cope with anything else. But what nobody tells you is that menopause is temporary. It's like a portal. And once you go through it and come out the other side, you're into this amazing phase.
Liberated, probably, in a way.
And that's what I wanted to say to women, is like, hang on in there, sister, because once you come out from the worst of menopause, life suddenly gets sweeter. And it's a big surprise, because nobody tells you that. And one of the main things and reasons why this period of life is so sweet, and some of this obviously holds true for men as well as for women, is that, well, for women, you're free from your biology. For the first time since you were 12, you're not worrying about periods, not getting pregnant, childbirth, menopause, all that stuff, which gives you logistical as well as practical as well as emotional stuff to deal with. For the first time, all of that is gone, and you're like, great, that's fantastic. The second thing is, if you're a parent, you have the freedom from your kids now. They mightn't have left home yet, and I don't know when our kids are ever going to leave home, but they don't want me or my husband looking at them 24/7. I don't need to make their dinners every night. I don't need to do their washing. I mean, if I'm there and I'm doing it anyway, fine, but I don't need to. I can take off and go wherever I want for as long as I want, and they're fine. That's a huge freedom. There's the freedom in your head, and especially for women, where you held all their stuff. Do you know, all the stuff, like their play dates, their extracurricular activities, their teachers' names, their subject choices, their exams, all of that took up a space in your brain, which is now free. You also have then the freedom from, and this started I noticed this first when I turned 40, that I stopped caring so much about what other people thought about me. And every decade since, I've cared less. So by the time you get to 60, you really don't give a flying fig about what people think of what you're doing, of what you're saying, of how you're dressing, of how you're presenting yourself. I don't really care. I care about what I do, how I look and all the rest of it. But I'm not looking for anybody's approval anymore. You know, whether you like it or don't like it is absolutely none of my business. That is massive. And then the other thing you have is you have the freedom from the fear of failure. Because when you get to 60, you'll have failed a few times and nobody will have died. You suddenly realise failure is just part of life. That makes you willing to try stuff. I'm now at the age where if somebody comes along to me with a proposal and says, you know, why don't you think of doing this? Like I did my first comedy gig earlier this year, last year. And if somebody had told me that I was going to do that even 2 weeks beforehand, I would have said no way. But I'm suddenly at the age where I think, why not? What's the worst that can happen? I die on my arse. So what? Nobody's going to die. I'm going to go home and say, right, we're never doing that again. That was terrible, but I tried it.
That is one of the scariest things to do. I mean, that is real liberation because it is, I mean, isn't that the ultimate fear that you're standing in front of an audience?
I don't know if it is, but like to me now, if you gave me a whole load of spiders to sort out, I think that would be worse. But yeah. No,
I think the spiders for me would be easier.
But like that, it's those delicious freedoms that I wanted to tell women. They're out there. And I would say to our men, but I would also say to younger women as well, don't assume you have to cram everything in to the years before you get married or the years before you settle down or the years before you have kids. You've got, if you're lucky and if you mind your health, you have got this other period of life that's coming down the tracks. And I had my other two kids late, so it may come earlier for some women. Say your mid-50s up until hopefully your mid-70s or late-70s is going to be years when you have the energy and you have the interest and you have the freedom to do a lot of the things that you may have put off doing while you were busy paying bills and paying a mortgage and trying to work hard and trying to mind your kids and do all of the stuff that we do when we're younger. Getting older, for me, is an amazing privilege. And we live in a society that is so ageist because we worship at youth. We think everything that's younger is better and everything that's older is worse. And that's actually not the case at all. And I think that older women have so much to offer. If they could just find the confidence and find their voices, I think we have so much to offer. And I think we are freer as well to rock boats, to be agitators, to cause problems, because I can't embarrass my kids anymore. I don't have a boss to worry about if I'm doing or saying something that's not going to play down well in work. My husband is well used to me at this stage and, you know, isn't that bothered either. You know,
brilliant.
Go out there and do all the things. And, you know, it doesn't have to be big things. It doesn't have to be traveling the world. It doesn't have to be doing anything spectacular. It can be, I want to learn how to paint. I've always wanted to see if I could paint. I want to write a book. I want to write poetry. I want to go and live on an island for a year. Whatever it is that you want to do, go and do it, because it's an amazing time of life.
The process of writing a book, I was listening to one or two of your chats and you were talking about when you did it all and you got to 75,000 words, etc., etc. Just talk us through that worked, and for people out there that are interested in doing what you're doing. And I think it's brilliant that you're writing and empowering people, but how did it go for you?
Well, what happened was I mentioned the fact that I was at home looking after my kids for 10 years, and that came to an end when the Celtic Tiger Upton died, and my husband's business fell off a cliff, and we were suddenly going, oh my God, we have no money. And I thought, okay, I need to get back to work. And it was a recession. I had just turned 50. I couldn't even get an interview, like never mind a job. So I was thrown back at my own resources and said, okay, what can I do? And I know I can write. And I thought, okay, I'd like to write and get paid for it and maybe do some radio. So that started me reinventing with no experience, with no contacts, with no blueprint, nothing. So I started doing a bit, and it's been a slow burn, but all the time in my head was this, someday I'd like to write a book. And it was one of those things that I kept saying, yeah, down the road at some stage, I'll write a book. And then COVID happened and lockdown, and my work more or less dried up. My husband's work dried up. We were cycling and walking to beat the band. But then I thought, I need something else. So I thought, now is the time. If you're ever going to do it, here you have been given this block of time. So now start to write the book. And I remember struggling a little bit because I do have the attention span of a goldfish and I move on very quickly. And so the idea of writing this big kind of body, and I mean, it's not an academic tome, like, but because it was longer, I was used to writing 1,000 words. To me, that was a long article. So I was like, yeah, okay, this is, I can do this. Just think of it as loads of like articles. So anyway, started writing the book. Finally got it to, as he said, around 75,000 words. And I thought, okay, grand, I've written a book. Gave it a quick edit. Went back, edited quickly, and chucked it out to every single publisher in Ireland, all of whom came back to me and said, we're delighted to receive your manuscript. We will have a look at it and we will come back to you. And then tumbleweed. Nothing. And I was stunned. I was like, wonder why nobody wants my book. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, and with the help of very nice, supportive, mainly women writers, I realised that what I'd sent out was the first draft. It was like serving up to somebody an unbaked cake. You know, it hadn't cooked.
Needed another 20 minutes.
It needed another lot of work. So I finally, and with some help of people, I got to read it and tried to help me. I started to edit it. And at one point, I know I wasn't happy. I felt it's still not working and still not right with it. I actually had to put it away for about 3 months and not look at it and then come back to it with kind of fresh eyes. And that was when I divided it up into the two sections that it's in. So the first section is, as I called it, the life audit. And the second section then is different headings and looking forward into your older years and the things that I think are important. And once I did that, I felt it worked better. But I'd blown the chance of, because, you know, all the publishers had this rubbish and thought like, oh my God. And I don't know how I'm ever going to get over that. Like, Barbara Scully's book, it was terrible. But anyway, I was very lucky in that an English startup publisher then was looking for non-fiction books and was jumped at it. And I mean, the guy who runs it, Zaza Publishing, is the company who published it, and it's basically one guy. He's a very nice English man. And when I realised he was 30, he was about the same age as my eldest daughter, I remember going, oh my God, he's so not going to get this book. But he totally got it. So he published it, and it was, I mean, I hoped it would resonate, but it really has resonated with women in particular. And that makes me very pleased. And I still get, you know, every week I get, the book's available on my website, which is barbarascully.com. It's also available on Amazon. It's more or less gone out of the bookshops now. I still, you know, I'm still getting orders every week, and I'm still getting people coming back to me saying, you know, that they really enjoyed it. And
yeah, and a few of my friends that read it, they thought it was just dripping with jewels of wisdom, I think. There's a lot of advice in the book that I also thought some of the things I read in the chapter were very good.
Oh,
I
mean, that's very kind of you.
And it's kind of dispelling, to a certain extent, fear.
Well, I hope that's what I'm doing, because what I really want to do, I mean, that's why I called it Wise Up. It was like, wake up.
Yeah.
Do you know, this is, I honestly believe, as I've talked about how I believe getting older, if you're lucky with your health, is delicious. But along with that, you've mentioned the word wisdom, and that's something I think is really important. And I'm not any wiser than anybody else, but I think one of the things that you learn, and I now do talks based on the book as well, and one of the things I start the talk with is saying that one of the things I discovered by doing the life audit, which I did inadvertently, and by a life audit I mean the first part of the book is me looking back at the adult decades of my life and the main kind of formative things that happened in each of those decades. So being a single parent, getting married, having more kids, you know, working, not working, whatever. And at the end of each decade, I've put a few little kind of, what would you call them, like hints of how you could do this yourself. And I think it's a really important thing to do as you get older, because I think, and again, this would be something I think particularly with women, we don't give ourselves credit for an awful lot of the stuff that we do because it's not valued by society. Caring, working in a home, you know, keeping a home running and all that kind of stuff. So what I discovered by doing the life audit, and I love this because I say this in my talk, is that Winnie the Pooh was actually right. And Winnie the Pooh said, and I won't get this right, but he said, you're smarter than you think, you're wiser than you think, and you're stronger than you know. I've butchered that, but that's the gist of it. And I think that's true. When you look back on your life, and we've all had, I haven't had a particularly special life, but we've all, you know, we've all managed to negotiate our way through difficult times, through trauma, through grief, you know, through success. And I think what you do when you look at it coldly, you go, I did get through that. And, you know, that does mean I'm stronger. So because of that, we all are wise. We all have wisdom, but I think sometimes we don't realise it. And I think that's another one of the great things about getting older, is that you suddenly have this kind of breadth of vision because you've got these decades that you can look back on and you can see patterns and you can see common threads. And I think that makes you understand about life in a way that obviously the younger you couldn't and younger people can't because they don't have that breadth of experience. And we all have that. And it's just a matter of us recognising that we all have that.
Amazing. And I mean, we've seen in the last 2 years, I mean, the explosion in, for example, sport, you know, women in sport now. Yeah. Politics is a bit of a strange one because there seems to be an awful lot of men involved in politics. There seems to be an awful lot of trouble going into the world of the world. So I think, I mean, for me, I think we need a lot of intelligent, wise women. And what do you think? Do you think that for you, in politics and stuff, it's not really attractive, is it?
Do you know, I would love to fix the world. Yeah, I mean, I there's loads of things.
Yeah, you probably could.
And actually, during the week I was very lucky. I moderated a talk on inspiring women, which was organised by the German Embassy and the Goethe Institute. And we had this tremendous conversation. And that was one of the things that actually did come up. And politics, you know, we've had gender quotas here now in our political election system for the last, you know, few years. And they have made a difference, but they haven't made enough of a difference. We still have somewhere around 25% of our TDs are women. That's very low. We're not a minority. We are 51% of the population and we only have 25% representation. Holly Cairns, who's the leader of the Social Democrats, and I'm not a member of any party, but I'm a fan of Holly. And she was posting the other day about Cork, which is where she's from, and probably my favourite county.
Thank you, Barbara.
I'm not just saying that, genuinely. But anyway, she said they have something like, I think it's 18 TDs in the whole county of Cork. It's the biggest county in the country.
Yeah.
There's only one woman. Yeah, Holly Cairns.
And that is shocking, because that wasn't the case.
No.
I mean, you remember you had the years of the Barry, Eileen Desmond, the Barrys. Yeah. I mean, there was always a great cohort of women.
We've always stuck at just around about 20%. Mm. We haven't managed to get beyond that. And what we need to get is critical mass. And they reckon critical mass is around 33%. And critical mass then means that these women will make a difference. And we're not a homogenous group no more than men are a homogenous group, no more than gay people are a homogenous group, no more than, you know, black people are a homogenous group. But women do bring something different to the table. And I think that we are designed in order to, I don't want all women taken over. I don't want a Doyle that's full of only women. I want it to be equal so that there is a balance, because we are definitely out of whack at the moment. And I think there's that. And I think the other thing we need to do is that feminism up until now has fought for women's equality in a system that was designed by men, for men. We now need to dismantle the system. The system of patriarchy, you know, focusing on what would be traditionally male values of power and aggression and, you know, hierarchy, needs to be dismantled. A matriarchal system, and I don't know anything about this, but a matriarchal system would be a more circular type of system rather than a triangular patriarchal hierarchical system. And I think that would benefit everybody. And again, this goes back to the fact that I think that older women have a latent power, and that we can use our voices, if we find our voice, to call for change. And that's one of the things that I think is really important, because younger women, and you know, I was that younger woman, I see my eldest daughter doing the same thing of, you know, in her 30s, small kids, working full time, husband working full time, big mortgage, trying to keep it all together.
Like, you're exhausted.
Yeah.
So they, much to do.
They don't have, you know, they don't have the bandwidth to kind of also get out and protest. And the awful thing is, we're still fighting for the same baloney that we were fighting for 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Why we don't have, for example, affordable, accessible childcare available to every family in the country is a disgrace.
I agree. Yeah. But I mean, Scandinavia, Sweden, it's par for the course there. You talk about female representation. When I go up, I love going up to Sweden and Stockholm and Denmark, Finland, and there's a much greater percentage of female representation. And they get voted the happiest countries in the world consistently. So there's a message there.
There absolutely is. And, you know, I think that until we do really solid things like care, valuing care, and I know we have a referendum coming up and I haven't decided about that yet, but we need to value the work that's involved in caring, which has traditionally been women's work, and therefore it has no value. And you know, one of the things that happened during COVID, when suddenly schools were closed, creches were closed, everywhere was closed, your workplace was closed, and you had families at home, two parents trying to work plus look after their children. Mm. And I remember, number one, thanking my lucky stars that I wasn't at that stage and going, I don't know if I could have done that. But number two, saying, maybe this will change things now. Maybe we will, after COVID goes, maybe we'll recognise the fact that care is important. It's vital. We need it. Let's value it more. Nothing changes. We went straight back to the system the way it is. I personally don't believe that care should be run for profit. I don't think anybody should be making a profit out of care. I don't think nursing homes should be run for profit. I have a friend who's looking at nursing homes for her, one of her parents at the moment. 2.5 grand a week.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And yet the people who work, the most of the people who work in the nursing home are care assistants on minimum wage or just above it. So...
You can work out the maths yourself.
Nobody should be profiting out of care. We all need care when we come into the world. We'll probably need a level of care going out. It should be a human right. It should be provided by the state through our taxes in the same way as education is provided.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that care is just a woman's issue, but I think because we are traditionally the ones who do the nurturing and caring and have done forever, we are the ones that need to say, hang on, this system is wrong and we need to fix it. And I think it would make for... I mean, the other thing I think that women have a really important voice in is stuff to do with the environment. I don't believe we would have destroyed the world to the extent that we have if we'd had more women involved, because women are much more naturally in tune and connected with the planet, with Earth, with nature. And I mean, some of the most important voices on climate change and on climate justice are Mary Robinson, who I think is an absolute, you know, a fantastic role model for older women. Jane Goodall, who's also talks about nature.
Yes, amazing.
And she's, again, I think she's well into her 80s. So there is a role for this kind
Jane Fonda is actually very good. I was listening to her the other day. Amazing woman. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's another Indian woman called Vandana Shiva, who's the same. So there are these matriarchal, older, wise women who aren't afraid to speak. Mary Robinson was very powerful in a lot of the stuff she said about Gaza as well recently, speaking truth to power, as she said, in a way that I haven't heard that many men do. And that's the kind of stuff we need to mine. And I believe that all women, you don't have to be Mary Robinson to make a difference. All women can make a difference. We all have a responsibility to call out stuff that we think is wrong, even if we're only talking about it in our own homes or in our own social circles or within our own communities. We need to not be afraid to call things out that we see are wrong.
Wonderful. Well, listen, Barbara, it's been a pleasure to give you a voice on the Sunday show this evening, because I actually could listen to you for 2 hours, you know, but where time is catching up with us. In a nutshell, I love the book, right?
Thanks,
as a man who's also probably very in touch with my feminine side, mm-hmm. and aside from saying that, but it's really packed full of really lovely stories. It's very entertaining.
And it's a light read.
And I'm nearly there, but I'm delighted that you wrote
Thanks
it.
So much.
I'm sure it's the first of many. Before we finish off, what would you say, top tip, or what would you say, leave us with a little nugget of wisdom that you think everybody should take on board?
We are the only species on the planet, I think, that laugh. And I think that there's a reason that we do that, and it is our safety valve. And I think if you can see the humour and the ridiculousness in life, it definitely helps you to get through it. I mean, I used to say to my husband, why do funny things always happen like to me, like weird stuff? And he goes, it's not that they happen to you, it's that you see them as being funny or see them as being ridiculous. And I mean, you can't do that always and every day, but I don't actually think life is meant to be taken that seriously all the time. There are some things that are obviously serious, but a lot of the stuff that we get stressed about and upset about is just ridiculous when you think about it. And it's easier to do that again when you're older, because you know that, oh, look, this will pass and it'll be better. So having a laugh every day is really important. Surround yourself with people who make you laugh. Very important.
Oh, I love it. The smile in the world is smiling with you. Tell me, when is your next stand-up gig? I want to go.
Stop.
Please tell me, what is that?
I think there's a pair of women called Chatterbox on Instagram, and they set up doing this comedy gig under the Funny Women banner. So they have another one coming up in May. But if you follow me on my Instagram, I'll be flagging it when it's... I can't remember the actual date off the top of my head, but it's in May. And I've said I'll do another one. But I mean, I'm not going to suddenly become a comedian. I don't think. But you know.
Well, I think it's there already. And listen, I'll be in the front row.
Will you? Okay, great. I'll hold you to that.
Barbara Scully, thank you for joining us this evening on The Sunday Show.
The Sunday Show with Epic, the Irish Emigration Museum, an interactive journey that shows how a small island made a big impact on the world. EpicCHQ.com. Sunshine. 106.8 Sunshine 106.8